Welcome, everyone. Now we begin with Professor Figueroa. Just a quick note on timing, 25 minutes for the talk, then 10 minutes for Professor Martinez's reply, and we will use the remaining time for questions. Professor Figueroa Rubio, please go ahead.
Thank you, Nicolas. Thank you, everyone, for being here and for inviting me, especially Diego and the Cathedra for organizing this amazing discussion on the splendid book of Guadalupe. I really recommend you to read the book because it's a very interesting book in several ways. One special issue is that she proposes a lot of paths to walk, to talk about responsibility in general, tort law in particular, and the relationship between different ways of live the responsibility within legal practices, but outside legal practices as well. And yeah, in the book you have moral issues, legal issues, social psychology, and so on. So it's really incredible. And I strongly agree with almost everything that is in there. So I would like here to transit some of the paths you propose and to start to explore them and to discuss some issues that appeared to me when I read the book. Also, some of the issues have been discussed, so I probably I will skip some points. I'm going to press more on some points compared to what is in the text I sent you. Okay, are you okay with that?
Yeah.
Okay, fair. For the sake of continuing the discussion. So, well, regarding the... let me tell you something about the name of the presentation. I talk about tort as an accountability practice. Mainly, my comment comes from philosophy, from social philosophy and practical philosophy, rather than from legal issues. And within this, the philosophical discussion of philosophy, there is a common, nowadays very common, distinction proposed by Gary Watson in his article Two Faces of Responsibility of 1996. And in that paper, he proposed to distinguish between responsibility as accountability and responsibility as attributability. And the point of this distinction is that on the one hand, we can discuss how the interaction, the exchanges of responsibility related to punishment, for example, and to how to react to wrongdoing has a specific ambit of discussion. And on the other hand, we can discuss about who is the responsible agent, what are the important elements of responsible agency. And even though it's not so easy to separate them, I think the model of presented in torts and retribution is primarily a model on accountability. And I think it's a very deep, very insightful view on accountability. So that's why I would like to discuss how the model, the relational retribution model presented, can help us to discuss in depth how we should understand accountability. So that's why that's the name I propose for this comment. Briefly, there are some elements we already discussed and Guadalupe has presented regarding how to understand accountability within the book. There are four elements I put in the presentation related to this. One is something that we have already discussed regarding the importance of the victim's perspective in order to understand this. And this is particularly important for tort law, for the discussion in private law, right? But it's also important for discussions on moral responsibility in general. But this is incorporated within a complex view on how victim and wrongdoer interact within a more complex context, which introduces social aspects, for example, some asymmetries you already discussed, but also institutional settings. So I think this is something very insightful from the book, the idea that we should think on accountability in this more broader context. Then these psychological elements of the victim, but also the importance of think about what is the relationship between moral responsibility and legal responsibility. There are some common discussions about this, but I think this is something that is interesting in the book, as it is a kind of new way of thinking of this. To present it, for example, a model on moral communication in order to explain an institutional practice as tort law, I think is very interesting. I'm going to delve with into this issue, especially because, as you said, you would like to introduce punishment and recognition as elements, right, of this equation. And finally, there is I think another important issue is the defense of a communicative model of punishment, right? Punishment is not just the expression of condemnation, for example. There is not just a way of compensate victims, but it's a sought for to generate a moral communication within society. And their recognition issues are very important, right? So having in mind this idea, this model, I hope to be fair with it, I'm going to introduce some questions related to three topics, right? These four issues, I think, will appear during my presentation. Now, the first issue is this: how to understand within the model of relational retribution on the interaction, how to think on the interaction of the victim with the wrongdoer, and which aspects of these persons are relevant in order to understand this moral communication model, this accountability model. And here, Guadalupe uses a distinction between the objective and the subjective in order to see how the elements of the equation operate. And as I said, and as we have been discussing, within the model are very important the drivers, the motives, the desires, the motivations of the victim, right? And for that, she deals with some intuitive reaction we have to some moral facts or some moral interactions, right? Such as, for example, this moral outrage as a kind of intuitive reaction, right? But at the same time, the story of the victim doesn't finish there, right? But it also incorporates these moral elements that I think are thick moral elements related to being evaluated within the society, to send a message written by the society, and to generate a kind of moral conversation in institutional settings. So here I have my first question related to how we really can connect these two issues. And because I think even though you give a space for this to try to go from these intuitive reactions to this moral discussion, it is not clear to me how these two aspects of the victim interact. Okay. On the one hand, we can say that, for example, with Victoria McGeer, you quote her, right? We can say that even though these intuitive reactions are important, they do not need to define the practice. We can deal with them within the practice for different issues, for different goals, right? Here I'm thinking of, for example, the importance of forgiveness, right, within the proposal of McGeer, right? So how we deal from this reaction to create a kind of practice or social practice, right? But at the same time, that's one thing. But on the other hand, we can ask ourselves not just why to incorporate them, but what happens with victims that do not feel or do not react naturally in these terms, right? And here we have probably two problems, right? One of them is the first question. Do they lack of moral agency in these terms? You said, for example, that not to feel or not to have this moral outrage is a sign of lack of self-respect, for example, right? But is this necessarily so? I'm not completely sure, right? Because if we are doing a model where the initiative of the victim is so important, right? What happens when the victim doesn't have these feelings? So in one sense, is she a bad victim and virtuous victim? And on the other hand, so if the victim doesn't feel these issues, these emotions and so on, then they lack of the entitlement to, for example, for a lawsuit, for example, and so on, in moral terms, because this is, I think, one of the problems of trying to build a moral communication model in order to explain a legal practice, right? Probably that's one of the issues. So that's one thing. But when we go to the other side of the equation, to the
wrongdoer,
we have a different picture, right? And probably we have an asymmetry here. Because you said that the psychological aspects of, if I read good your book, the psychological aspects of the wrongdoer are not so important. First, because the wrong is an objective issue that doesn't need to be identified of psychological issues, right? Motives and so on. But on the other hand, because punishment doesn't imply suffering, and we are not sick of suffering when we apply punishment. So you are defending a communicative model of punishment, right, without suffering. I think that's what you tried to do in your book. But I think it probably instead of suffering, you go to the pocket of the wrongdoer, right? And you say, for example, that the punishment, the monetary sanction, should be onerous and burdensome and so on, but that doesn't imply suffering, right? That doesn't imply suffering. And I'm not so sure about this, again, because it seems that you're trying to separate the economic life, the monetary life of people from their suffering in some sense. But it seems to me that it's not clear to me why, for example, then victims are allowed or are entitled to receive money as a moral communicative right way of acting. So in that sense, I'm not sure why you're trying to avoid suffering. Yeah, I'm going to back this. So I see in the model a kind of asymmetry that has these two sides. In the subjective elements of the equation, victims' subjective intuitive elements are very important. Wrongdoers' elements are not that important, at least. And then the life of the wrongdoer is centered in his pocket or her pocket, while the life of the victim is a very rich one, right? It includes the value of life, self-worth, self-esteem, and so on, right? Why, one can ask, why the wrongdoer cannot be seen in the same way, right? Even though it's not a natural person, right? We have theories for dealing with this. Right? So that's my first concern related to how to understand this interaction. Okay? And always I'm thinking of this because you are trying to understand this in terms of recognition, right? So yeah, it's not easy to deal with this, obviously. Then the second point is related to punishment. With punishment, and I'm going to say some things that I have already said. The first thing is why the harm, there are 2 points. One is the harm condition, a famous condition in punishment theory, or the, And on the other hand, what I call the money condition. I think you propose a kind of money condition. In your answer previously, I think you tried to not to be so strong in your defense of money, but I think in the book you have a strong defense of the importance of money in order to understand punishment. But regarding the harm condition, the, usually in Feinberg's, Hart's classic views on punishment, punishment is related to inflict some kind of suffering, so harsh treatment in people, right? And this is particularly important for communicative views of punishment, I think. And for example, Linda Ratzik defends this. You use Linda, you quote Ratzik works on punishment as well. The same with Michael McKenna. And they say that if we don't have this hard treatment element, we cannot deal with, for example, with the difference between blaming, for example, and punishing, because we have private blame and we can express blame without having the entitlement to inflict suffering and so on. But on the other hand, because it seems that the communication of for example, a condemnation implies some kind of punish of suffering. So for example, this is Ratzik's idea, right? When you censor someone publicly, you affect her reputation, for example. And when you say that she acted wrong and so on, you are affecting some interests that are very important interests that are related to the social lives of persons and with the image a person have from herself, of herself. So in that sense, suffering is part of the equation, right? So I'm not sure why you're trying to avoid it. I know there are some reasons related to, right, to the market and how in the chapter 6 you see that there are different kinds of accountability practices, right? But I think we can continue using it because in those scenarios, it precisely is we're thinking Ratzik when she proposes this idea of social punishment as including the harm condition. And the second point is the money condition. Okay, I think you propose a kind of money condition in order to defend the justification of punitive damages in general, but punishment in particular, but punishment in general in some sense. And here, I think, appears again the discussion why money, right? And I think there are, I would like to push there in 2 different ways, okay, at this point. The first is, if we want to take seriously the value of victim in a moral communication model, right, we can ask why money is appropriate for that, right? And here we can use different models of moral value where usually money is not part of it, right? So I propose some ideas in the text. So I quote, for example, Martha Nussbaum's criticism on Rawlsian's views that are always discussing on money, right? But it seems like personal value and especially social esteem and so on are connected with other issues. For example, if you work in philosophy of recognition, it can be seen as a pathology to use money to solve problems that are moral, right? Indeed, it's a kind of reification, for example, of suffering and so on. So in some sense, we can say that money is ill-suited, right? It's not the answer. It's the opposite of a good answer, if we go there, right? If we want to go there, right? So in that sense, we can say we need to criticize the way punitive damages have been treated, right? Not to abandon them, but why to center them on money, right, in the money issue. And then, right, following what we discussed, we can say, well, it seems that everything that you want that money do within the accountability practice can be done by different means, right? People can say that. And I think that's part of the discussion. That is the previous discussion. If you need to communicate to the people that the victim has moral worth, you don't need to pay them money or to give money or to ask money from the wrongdoer. If you need to punish the wrongdoer, you don't need to take money from them, and so on, right? It seems that you always have another possibility. So people can ask, why money again, right? So that's the point regarding money. So I would like to discuss more. My point is, why not to be more radical, right? against money, if recognition is the point in this kind of practice. And finally, I think this point follows from the other one. I wonder how ideal is your proposal on tort law at the end of the book. In social philosophy, there's this discussion between ideals and non-ideals theories. Usually the problem with ideal theories is that they reject or they neglect some elements of society or the social practices that are relevant in order to understand what is really happening, okay? And this could be problematic, I'm not sure if it is, because in some sense you are, from the beginning of the book, you are saying that we do not draw enough attention to psychological aspects, social aspects of the practices of accountability in general and tort law in particular, right? And here I think we can incorporate three, for example, elements to discuss regarding this issue. The first is something, again, remarked by social recognition theories. For example, Judith Butler talks about this, Axel Honneth, and so on. They said that always when you have a discursive practice of a practice regulated by norms, institutional practice, social accountability practices, they are developed over a background of norms that usually are not clearly expressed in the practice, but they are operating there, right? And in, for example, we have these ableism norms, racism, sexism, and so on. These phenomena are usually present in there, right? So the very conditions for define, for example, what is a victim or what kind of behavior is outrageous, for example, right? In some sense, are defined by these norms, right? So if we accept this, we go further with this kind of argumentation, we have these two possible problems. The first is that what victims do in lawsuits are just reproducing the norms that are given to them by our society, right? So the narratives, the scripts, the way they interpret their own experience, or most radically, the only way they have to interpret their own experience are with the language they receive from their society and the categories they receive from their society, right? So to be a victim in that sense is, for some people, is to identify yourself as a victim, for example, is a kind of alienation from the very beginning, right? This is a more radical view on the idea. So in that sense, when you go and suit another person as a victim, in that sense, you are already playing the oppressive game, right? Because oppressive system needs for victims in order to live, right? It's not the oppressor who defines an oppressive system, right? To give stability. And finally, the last point regarding to this issue is, I don't know what you think about these studies on legal consciousness that discuss these issues, right? Because I think when the studies of legal consciousness has shown that it's very difficult for people who's vulnerable to trust in the system, right? And usually the system what do is just to reproduce their vulnerabilities. So in that sense, for some people, the very institutional setting is an oppressive one, right? So you don't have this potential you're trying to put within the tort law trials, right? So I don't want to be pessimistic, but it's just, I really would like to know what do you think about these issues. So thank you very much for the book, and thank you everyone for listening.
Thank you, Professor Figueroa. Now we have Professor Maria Guadalupe for a 10-minute reply. Professor, please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Sebastian, for your comments. I think I will start by saying that I don't see tort law as the beginning and end of the problem, right? And this is just to emphasize a little bit of how I locate tort law in when I think about all these problems, right? And so I actually think of tort law within a web of institutions that are doing the work here. And so I see that as one aspect, right? And so I think the complementarity and how I see this institution, and particularly the punitive damages institution, would be a narrow institution within this institutional setting in a way. So I don't have, it cannot solve everything, right? So this is just to give an understanding of what I'm thinking when I think about tort law in general, no? What it can do, in the sense that you are totally right, is limited. And I will get back into your last point, which I think is very interesting. But yeah, it's certainly limited to deal with that. But still, I think I can give you something there. But let's start from the beginning, because I think it's... thank you very much for pointing out the asymmetry. Because actually, I was thinking after reading your comments and now your presentation, there is an asymmetry from the very beginning, right? And so the defendant is creating that asymmetry when when the reprehensible wrong is happening. And so this is, I see an asymmetry there. And what relational retribution and punitive damages are doing is trying to counterbalance that asymmetry. So I see the asymmetry in a different moment than you see it. And I think it's there. So the idea of a counterbalance, the power, is to counterbalance this asymmetry that was there in the original place, in the first place. This is one aspect of the asymmetry. And this is why I resort to retributive motivations, because what they tell us is that victims are reacting, responding to an asymmetry that was imposed on them. And so I see the asymmetry more there, but it's definitely an asymmetry. And then the asymmetry that I think it worries you is this move from objective to subjective. And there, I think, thank you very much for your point on suffering, because I want to make clear that, of course, it's a hardship, it's a suffering. So relational retribution, it's actually about that. You are totally right. The hardship, the suffering is what is doing the communicative work. And actually, is this creation of the new depth what makes the recognitional element? So hardship and the imposition of a suffering or a burden, I call it in different ways along the book, is an essential part of the theory. I think what makes your comment, or perhaps your comment comes from, because what I'm trying to do is saying that we don't need to look at the subjective suffering of the defendant in order to quantify the punitive damages. And so it's for the quantification where you're totally right, there I distinguish the economic life from the subjective life. This is correct. But I do it for in the proportionality framework that I am offering. So it's from the quantification. And there what I say is we don't need to know the details of the specific kind of pain the victim, the defendant is going to suffer because of the imposition of the sanction. And what I do that is because, and here I have to say I have a struggle with the proportionality theory. I mean, criminal law theories struggle themselves with proportionality heavily. And so it was very hard for me. Peter is saying yes, so it's good. So it was very hard for me to really dig into proportionality and try to find out how to bring this concept that is so vague and contested, even in the criminal law theory realm. And so what I wanted to clarify is that the subjective experience of the defendant was irrelevant to avoid some kind of criticism on that regard, and also because I didn't need it for the theory. But that's why I got there. Probably I didn't need to say anything about that, but I thought in the proportionality discussion for criminal law theories, it made sense to show we don't need to apply relational retribution in the moment of quantification to look at the defendant that the amount of money is going to mean more pain or more suffering, right? And so they get into this, you know, like a person who had led a luxurious life, 1 year of imprisonment is much harder than from a beggar that was living in the street the whole life, right? So this is a subjective suffering. So just to make it clear, it is a suffering, it is a hardship, it's just not subjective one. I don't need to get into the subjective suffering. That's the trick.
There is not subjective suffering?
Yeah, I mean, quantify.
Does not subjective suffering exist?
No. It might, but it's not necessary for the quantification. So I'm not denying there is suffering. There is. It's part of the theory. So it's a hardship, it's a burdensome, it's a suffering. But I don't need to know how much. I don't need to know the measure of the subjective suffering in order to quantify it. That's basically the comment. But it is a suffering, yeah. The second point, it's on, I lost a little bit of the track. The second point is again is about why money, right? And actually, yeah, I am critical of commodification theories, as you say. I try to be, of course, it's, at the end of the day, again, I think I come back to the same idea because I can find another idea of like, thinking about money that trying to offer, to show how money can send different messages. And I come back to this expressive idea of money. But I am critical of the commodification. I would sympathize a lot with, maybe we should solve it in a different way. But this is just the way that the legal system, tort law deal with. But also because it's the creation, money is what give, in a way, teeth to the sanction, right? And so it's this idea that I mentioned at the very beginning of control of the power, that this control extends to the enforcement of the judgment as well. And so this power of the victim to enforce the judgment and the amount of money, I think is clearer when amounts of money are on the other side than when you have to enforce, I don't know, an apology or something else. I think there are a lot of problems that we will have to deal with that. But money is not the ideal answer, I will agree. But still, I think we can work with it. And so this is what I would say. We can keep discussing that. And as I said, it's not ruling out complementary measures that are more sympathetic to the answer that money is unsatisfactory somehow, no? Like apologies or injunctions and so on. So relational retribution is compatible with that. And your last point, I think it's very interesting on the limits of the tort process. And this is something that I thought a lot, you know, how limited is the adversarial tort process in the very beginning. Of course, you're bringing a more deeper understanding of how, the inequalities, that structural inequalities in society reflect also in the tort process, and I will agree. And here I would say that, tort law is limited and it cannot solve structural issues of that sort. But what I would say is that I see some some contributions there, because what I'm thinking of the victim is an epistemic empowerment, right? So this is basically the idea that I think it's important in that aspect, is that victims are creating knowledge, and they are especially situated to create that knowledge because they are the ones who are being harmed, who were harmed, right? So they possess information that few others possess. And I think this epistemic empowerment cannot solve the structural issues, but can expose them. And so I see some indirect contribution, in a way, of the theory to expose structural problems, to send signals to the regulators, legislators, to send, to create institutional knowledge about or oppressive practices or inequalities that they are out there. And that's why I think it is important, because if we don't have lawsuits, if we don't create knowledge, if we don't create this kind of information, we are steps behind in your line. But of course, that would be fantastic if Dr. could do that. But I think it might help indirectly. Thank you so much.